It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with the latest on the race for the Senate and demands from Congress for a more active role in response to the Islamic militant group ISIS.
First, a look at the latest action from that organization and its release of a video showing the beheading of another American journalist. The group calls the video a second message to America to stop airstrikes in Iraq. It shows the beheading of journalist Stephen Sotloff, the second journalist killed by the terrorist group.
Jeremy Suri is with us now to talk about how the U.S. could respond to these messages. He's the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership and Global Affairs, History and Public Policy at the University of Texas Austin and the LBJ School of Public Affairs. His latest book is Liberty's Surest Guardian. Jeremy, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob. Nice to be on.
So one journalist, then another in these horrific videos, the threat in the latest video of another victim. Do you expect to see more and more videos like this from ISIS as long as the U.S. is involved there?
I expect that we'll see more of these videos in the coming weeks and months because they're having the effect that ISIS wants. They're drawing attention. They're scaring people. And they're making the foreign powers, including the United States, look somewhat weak and helpless. So I think we'll see more of these.
And there have been calls from some in Congress and elsewhere that the United States should step up efforts in Iraq in response and maybe in Syria against ISIS. What's in our toolkit? What can we do that we haven't been doing already?
Well, there are some things we can do, but we do have to begin, Rob, by recognizing there are limits on what we can do insofar as we don't want to send a large occupation army, and there are good reasons why we don't want to send a large occupation army to the region. And what we are trying to do, of course, is to use air power and allies on the ground to turn the tide against ISIS, to contribute to their defeat on the battlefield and their being forced out of the areas they're occupying. It does seem to me there are a few additional things we could do. We can certainly try to share more intelligence that we have on where members of ISIS are with other groups on the ground. We're often hesitant to share intelligence because we don't know how they're going to use it. And I think we can also probably do a better job of warning Americans to get out and other civilians to get out of these areas. But once Americans and others are captured, there are very limited things we can do, and it's generally not a good strategy to try to go in and just bomb random areas because we don't actually know where the hostages are being held in many cases.
The president has said anything short of boots on the ground, but there's pressure out there for some kind of a response. Is there some way we might find ourselves starting with airstrikes, then more advisors, and kind of backing into a land conflict?
Well, there certainly is a lot of historical precedent for that, Rob, as you know. So that's certainly a possibility. We should also acknowledge that we already have put new boots on the ground. When we send in special operations forces to try to rescue people, or when we send in special operations forces to train fighters on the ground, both of those are things we're doing now. We are actually putting more boots on the ground. So we are doing some of that. I think there's a very strong prohibition in American politics today against a large commitment of American ground troops. So I don't foresee that happening in the next few weeks and months, but I do expect we'll see escalating American efforts from the air with small insertions of force of our own and aiding other groups, particularly Middle Eastern groups that we're working with, including the Iranians, to do some of this for us, especially in Iraq.
Well, the strategy seems to be to provide the air support side of the equation for Kurdish Peshmerga fighters, for the Iraqi army, such as it is. Is that enough to tip the balance for those ground forces already there, already with a stake in defeating ISIS, to help turn the tide on the Iraqi side of the equation?
No, it's certainly not, because if those forces on the ground were adequate to start with, and if they were organized appropriately and had popular support on the ground, you wouldn't see ISIS rising this way. The best way to understand the rise of ISIS is to focus for a second less on the extremism of the group and more on the power vacuum that's been created. What you've had through parts of Iraq and now Syria and parts of Yemen and elsewhere is a collapse of organized political authority, rampant corruption and factionalism, some of which we have contributed to unintentionally. And that's opened up a space similar to what happened with the Taliban after the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan in the late 1980s. That ISIS is filling, and airstrikes are not going to create order on the ground. They're going to make it harder for ISIS to expand. But if we really want to see the tide turned, there has to be an organized, compelling force on the ground to do this. And it better not be Americans, because that's only going to reinforce the extremism that we're seeing there.
As complicated as things are in Iraq, they're more complicated maybe in Syria. We don't know who we would be bombing ISIS to help, it seems like.
Right. Well, we're in a terrible situation in Syria in that we, for very good reasons, want to see Bashar Assad step down. But the ISIS forces are the ones fighting him in many cases, or they're one of the dominant forces fighting him. So if we take action against ISIS in Syria, which it looks like the president will do, we are helping Assad's case. If we support Assad, then we're helping the person we want, the person who uses chemical weapons, the person we want to see leave power. It's also complicated because the Iranians in Syria are supporters of Assad's. So although we might be working with them in Iraq, it's hard to work with them in Syria. The best option for us in Syria, it seems to me, is to try to find anti-Assad forces that are not necessarily committed to ISIS or might be working with ISIS, but might be willing to pursue a different agenda. But I don't know if such forces really exist.
It seems like the only thing that could defeat ISIS there is if everyone else agreed, okay, ISIS is the common enemy, let's stop fighting each other, let's stop trying to get, you know, our own best advantage out of this situation that ISIS is creating. Is there any chance of something like that happening?
Well, I think, Rob, that's one way ISIS gets defeated, but I think it depends what we mean by defeat. ISIS is not going to be able to govern effectively for the long term. They're a group of different factions that have come together out of convenience at this moment. What's likely to happen if they're not stopped in the short run is that they'll establish short-term authority in multiple areas. They'll continue to do horrific, truly horrific things, and then they'll start fighting among themselves. That shouldn't make us feel comfortable, though, because the worry we have, and this is one of the lessons of Afghanistan, is if they start doing what I just described, they might bring their fighting far beyond their own territory, including our territory. And so that's the concern we have. I'm not concerned about a long-term ISIS empire. What I'm concerned about, and I think what most people in Washington are concerned about, is that ISIS in its internal expansion will in the short run bring horror not only to those on the ground, which is bad enough, but to those far away.
Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That was foreign policy expert Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas, Austin. His latest book is Liberty's Surest Guardian. He's with us to talk about the latest videos released by ISIS and what, if anything, the United States can do in response. It's time now for our weekly look at Congress. Yesterday, as we just heard, ISIS released the video of a second American journalist being beheaded. And as tension between the U.S. and ISIS rises, some legislators are calling for the president to ask for permission from Congress before advancing new offensives against the group.
And the fight over the Senate is heating up between Republicans and Democrats. A record-shattering $400 million in early money has been spent on the race, but it still appears to be in limbo. David Cannon is with us now. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison. David, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Well, let's start with the congressional response to ISIS. It seems as though there is some pressure to act there on the president and also Congress asking for a greater voice. How would you say it's going down?
Well, I think with the response we've heard from all the critics of President Obama, there are a whole range of critiques that are coming from Congress right now. And there's no single voice of what should be done there other than to say that they agree that President Obama has failed in his foreign policy, at least on the Republican side of the House. Everyone is saying that we need to do something differently, but no one has a great alternative. And as your previous segment outlined, the situation with ISIS is incredibly complex, and there are really no easy answers that, you know, if we could, you know, bomb one part of their, you know, strongholds and have a good outcome, we would do that. But clearly that's not going to happen. That's not an easy answer. So the Republican critique, it ranges from those who, you know, want to send troops there to those who, you know, want to have, you know, more of a voice. But there's no coherent message coming from Congress right now other than just it's anti-Obama, basically.
Well, the president said last week that he didn't have a cohesive policy for how to deal with ISIS at the moment, and that seems to have ruffled a lot of feathers. Why do you think that was such a contentious thing to say?
Well, it was a contentious thing to say, but I think it was an honest thing to say. I don't think that anyone has the magic plan on how to solve the problem. And for those who want more aggressive action, you can just look at the ISIS response to the last round of bombing, which they themselves say is the reason for the second beheading, is that this is retribution for the bombing for the first beheading. And so if the goal is to stop ISIS from engaging in more terrorist acts like beheading journalists, then clearly there's no easy way to make that stop. And so I think Obama's admission that he did not have any clear plan here, on the one hand, sounds like you want stronger leadership coming from the White House. On the other hand, I think he's being straightforward with the American people that we just don't have any good solution right now.
Well, in the absence of that, some members of Congress are saying, you know what, we're going to grab the ball and start it rolling. What sorts of things are we hearing from foreign policy leaders in Congress?
Well, again, there's no single voice. I mean, John McCain the other day said that he does want a stronger response, and including potentially some more troops in Iraq. I think where foreign policy leaders in Congress have a harder time agreeing is exactly what to do with Syria and how you address the ISIS problem in Syria, because that's wrapped up then, as your previous expert Jeremy Suri said, they're really anything you do to stop ISIS actually is going to help Assad, and so that's an additional complexity there.
Do you see all these disparate voices in Congress coming together and some sort of legislation coming forward in the absence of a White House plan?
It's possible but unlikely, because I think that it's not to have both the Republican House and the democratically controlled Senate come together with a single approach seems to me incredibly unlikely. I mean, the Congress right now is as dysfunctional as any time in recent memory, where the two houses of Congress really can't agree on much of anything. And, they can't even pass budgets in a timely way. So to get them to agree on complex foreign policy issues seems to me to be a real reach.
Do you see any danger in the pressure coming from Congress? You're saying it's sort of a muddled chorus of voices right now, but should those voices, do you think, reach a pitch where they will force the president's hand?
Well, that is certainly possible, and I think the fact that the public also seems to want to have some kind of stronger action here, I think there will be pressure on the president to do something. But his approach to this point has been to try to build coalitions, to try to get UN resolutions behind any kind of action, and that takes time. It takes time to put together alliances and in favor of a coherent policy, and so that works against any kind of quick action. So yes, there will be pressure from Congress. Whether or not that ends up forcing Obama's hand, or if he stays the course with his more cautious coalition-building approach, remains to be seen.
Now, does President Obama need congressional approval before taking further action against ISIS? We've seen airstrikes, but what about beyond that?
Well, of course, we have at least a 40-year debate on this, running back to the end of the Vietnam era and the War Powers Resolution, in terms of what the relative position of Congress to the president are in terms of sending troops. While the War Powers Resolution has been in effect for about 40 years now, presidents have always maintained their unilateral authority to use force what necessary to protect American interests. And Congress, while complaining about that bitterly for both Democratic and Republican presidents, they still generally go along with that presidential use of force. And so my sense is, if President Obama did eventually decide on a course of action, it would, while still having its critics in Congress, Congress would not be able to really stop those kinds of unilateral decisions by the president.
Well, let's turn to the battle now for the Senate. Now, the big question in these midterm elections is, will the Senate flip? Will the Republicans get control of the Senate? How would you answer that question right now?
Well, my favorite sort of prognosticator is Nate Silver, 538.com, and he just came out with his midterm model that he's had for the last several years today, and he has a 63.9% chance of Republicans taking over control of the Senate right now. So, and his sort of modal prediction of, you know, his 10,000 simulations he does for his forecasting model has a 52-seat Republican Senate. Now, while that sounds like a pretty good edge for the Republicans, you know, 64-36 in terms of the probability of taking the Senate, when you dig a little deeper and look at the races, this is still really very much a toss-up kind of situation, because 16 of the 36 Senate races are too close to call right now in terms of the margin of error. And six of those are just, you know, razor thin and could go either way. And so while the Republicans certainly have an edge right now, and if the elections were held today, you know, indeed there's a pretty good chance they would take the Senate. But with that many races so close, this is still very much up for grabs.
And let's talk about the money being spent in this race. What are we looking at in terms of numbers?
We'll break all records for midterm elections this election for sure, with, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars already being spent, and not only for the Senate but also gubernatorial races around the country. The amount of outside money, this is a, you know, relatively new development for midterm elections. We've seen outside money in presidential elections for the last, you know, two, three presidential election cycles. But in a lot of congressional races now, for both the House and the Senate, you have outside money, that is money that's not being spent by the campaigns themselves, actually being greater than the amount of money being spent by the candidates. And so that's, again, a relatively new development in midterm elections, and it almost certainly will be a record amount of money this election cycle.
Now, as I understand it, there has been more money raised on the Republican side. Do you see that being the deciding factor, or do you expect more money to flow in later in the race to Democrats?
Well, right. The Republicans do have an edge right now, and often you see that advantage to the out party. So the party that's not controlling the White House, you know, typically has an advantage in midterm elections. The out party almost always picks up seats in midterm elections. Indeed, in the last 100 years, the only three exceptions to that were in 1934, in the middle of the Great Depression, 1998 with a backlash against the Clinton impeachment, and then in 2002 in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. So it has to be some pretty big, dramatic set of circumstances to not disadvantage the president's party. So the president's party is almost always disadvantaged. And we're seeing that play out in this midterm election for sure, both in terms of the, you know, the pickups the Republicans are likely to make, but also in terms of the money. And you see out parties, you know, generally having an advantage in raising money because contributors see this as a chance to, you know, pick up some seats.
Now, if we want to pay attention to the seats that are really the flashpoints of these midterms, what should we be watching? Where?
So the ones that everyone's looking at, I think, most closely are Iowa, Colorado, North Carolina, Alaska, Arkansas. Those are probably the top five of the really, you know, too close to call, coin flip kind of races. Then the next tier would include Georgia, Michigan, Louisiana would be probably the next ones that are at least, you know, relatively close. And so that's, and each of the top ones I mentioned, of those top six, each of those are right now leaning towards the Republicans, but just barely leaning towards the Republicans. And so, you know, a lot of things could change over the next couple of months to tilt that back to the Democrats' advantage. So let's say, you know, the economy continues to strengthen and we have a couple of good jobs reports in a row and economic activity picks up, consumer spending picks up. I think that would, you know, be enough to tip it back to the Democrats in some of these key races. If, on the other hand, you know, the economy slows down, the jobs numbers aren't quite as good over the next couple of months, then I think we're probably looking at a Republican Senate.
Now, going into this race, Republicans have been hoping that the narrative would be the Affordable Care Act and that, you know, if people are opposed to that, they would vote against Democrats in the midterms. That doesn't seem like it's turning out to be the prevailing narrative. So what is? Is it jobs, the economy, or is it, you know, maybe turning on something like foreign policy?
Well, midterm elections rarely turn on foreign policy. I mean, unless it's something like the 9/11 attacks that, you know, is really, you know, central to, you know, everyone's, you know, paying attention to that and everyone, you know, is aware of that. So it's unlikely to be foreign policy unless, of course, the situation really deteriorates in Syria and Iraq, and things, you know, get much worse, and we, you know, say end up having to send some troops in, you know, then that could become relevant in the midterm elections in a way that could be decisive. And so you're absolutely right that Obamacare has kind of receded as a important issue in these midterms, largely because it seems to be working better than the critics, you know, thought it would be at this point. More people are signing up, and so it's just not the same kind of a potent issue to use as it was, as it looked like it would be earlier this year when healthcare.gov was having all those problems online and people couldn't sign up and so on.
And we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
That was David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison. Paul Singer will be back with us for next week's On Congress.
The number of private photos of over 100 celebrities, including actress Jennifer Lawrence, were hacked and released onto the internet this weekend. How exactly the images were grabbed is still under investigation by the FBI and Apple, but it appears that a group of hackers collected the images in a months-long effort, getting them from Apple's cloud storage service.
The story has raised questions about how secure any of us are online, especially in the era of the cloud, when our personal documents, information, and photographs aren't stored on the machine we're working on, but out there somewhere.
Fred Cate joins us now. He's Distinguished Professor of Law and Senior Fellow at the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University. Fred, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Before we get deeply into the cloud, are we getting an idea of exactly how these photos were obtained?
Well, I think what you described is exactly what we know at this point. Apple says it was not a direct attack on their system, rather it was people coming in by impersonating the legitimate account owners. So, you know, what we would think of as more traditional account fraud.
Well, stepping back a bit, let's talk about what exactly the cloud is.
Well, you know, the cloud is really sort of a fancy term that doesn't have any clearly defined meaning, but the idea, and it's been around quite some time, is that we store our data remote from us. So unlike having it, you know, in your hands or in the computer on your desk, or even in the server that may be located down the hall, you're storing your data out someplace where you don't know, and that's where the phrase the cloud came from. And typically big companies, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, certainly, you know, they have big data centers around the world, and they back up the data in these different data centers. And then when you need it, no matter what device you're using, you can access the data. And so that's the other sort of cloud feature, that it's kind of ever-present. It's the big thing right now in technology, and you know, even software providers like, say, Microsoft are trying to get you to use cloud-based services. So rather than owning your copy of Microsoft Office, you would actually access it remotely from the cloud, and then you would get the products you need at any given time, whether you're on an iPad or a desktop or a laptop.
Is it likely that a lot of us are using the cloud and not really knowing that we're using it?
We are all using the cloud, every one of us, probably without exception. So if you have any sort of smartphone, you're using the cloud. If you are using any social media, you're using the cloud. And frankly, even things like banking records, airline records, Amazon, eBay, these are all cloud-based services.
Now, Apple has said that this isn't a sign that their entire cloud storage was hacked. It seems to have been isolated to these celebrity accounts. But given that, and that with enough tenacity, it was hackable, how concerned should we be?
Well, we should be concerned. I mean, I don't want to encourage panic here. Most of us are protected to a certain extent by anonymity. There are just too many of us, and nobody really cares about who we are. But this attack appears, and I use the word appear because we still don't have a report from the FBI who's investigating, but to have really involved two separate approaches. And one was the fact that sometimes passwords or the answers to challenge questions aren't very strong. And particularly if you use a password that's related to you, a child's name, a pet's name, a birth date, it's pretty easy for other people to figure that out. The other thing is, it again appears that this attack involved a technology that lets a computer try multiple passwords against an interface. And Apple hadn't set a limit on that. Now, as of Friday, it has set a limit. So now you don't get an infinite number of tries before you get locked out. But at that point, it was still allowing an infinite number of attempts to get into your cloud backup service.
Are there things that you would suggest individuals and businesses, for that matter, do their best to keep off of cloud-based servers?
Well, I think it's really important to remember that cloud-based service is a broad term to describe a lot of things. It's just like we say, I go to the doctor, but there's a big difference between the, you know, the nurse practitioner or the specialist, you know, cancer specialist or heart specialist. So most businesses, particularly large businesses using the cloud, are using commercial cloud services. They have contracts. They have very strong security. And, I mean, given that most hospital records and bank records are already in the cloud, it seems a little silly. It's a little too late to start talking about keeping things out of the cloud. On the other hand, for individuals, you know, I'm not sure I would have stored a nude picture of myself anywhere where it could be accessed by somebody else, whether that's a cloud or whether that's a server of my employer or any other place. So at a certain point, you know, the advice we often give, for example, students at the university is if you make it accessible via the web, you've got to assume somebody's going to access it. And therefore, if it's going to be interesting, if it's going to be tantalizing, if it's going to be highly valuable, they're going to have an incentive to try to access it.
But what is the incentive in this case? I mean, as far as I can tell, the people who did this didn't profit from it. They posted it on Reddit and somewhere else seemingly for free. Why? I mean, what is the point if it's not really got a monetary exchange?
It's a great question, but this isn't really a commercial market. There's much more involved in hacking about bragging rights, about being the first to do it, about getting something nobody else could get. And let's face it, a huge amount of traffic online involves sexually explicit expression. So when you talk about getting access to nude pictures of a famous celebrity, that's going to have a lot of bragging rights and a lot of interest attached to it. And that's got its own value, even if it's not measured in dollars.
There's been some of what people have called victim blaming here, people making the case the mistake was on the part of celebrities for taking these compromising photos, having them somewhere in their technological landscape. Is it fair to blame them in part for not being more careful?
Well, I would be very careful here about using the word blame. In other words, there was a criminal who broke in, and that's fundamentally who's to blame. And then there are questions about who else bears responsibility. Apple made it too easy to break in. They certainly have some responsibility. If individuals picked weak passwords, they have some responsibility. I personally think taking a nude photo of yourself and making it accessible via the cloud is the smartest thing to do. I wouldn't blame someone for doing that. But on the other hand, I would say common sense might have suggested that wasn't a great idea.
So if you are someone who's watching all of this happen, what is the next step? I mean, can we assume that, you know, people who house cloud storage will beef up their security and the rest of us will all be better off, that there will be new laws in place because of this? What's the outcome?
Well, I don't know. That's a great question. And I think a lot of people are waiting to see what the answer is. No question about what security is going to be beefed up. And again, we've already seen Apple make a very important change. It is, I think, significant to note that right now there really aren't any legal requirements around this. So Apple provides security because it's in its business interest to do so, but it's not required by law to provide security. And so maybe we see some laws in place, either from Congress or from state legislatures, saying, look, if you provide services to the public, you've got to protect them in the same way that the auto industry has to protect the public, or, you know, we expect other, you know, doctors and banks to protect the public. One reason why law might be useful here is one problem that right now online service providers have is when they do insist on good security, the public hates it. You know, we don't like being told, pick up stronger password, you know, change it every month. You've used a new computer, you have to re-verify yourself. We get really unpleasant about that, and a lot of complaints that companies get are about good security. If Congress required good security, then everyone would be doing it, and there would be less, if you will, competitive reason to offer bad security.
Did we, and I'm using the word we very broadly here, rush into the world of the cloud headlong without thinking about the consequences?
Oh, no question about it. And of course, we did it largely because it saves money. You have to remember that the sort of evolution of digital technologies, computers and networks and smartphones and so forth, over the past 30 years has been not just about improved power and service, but it's also been about trying to cut costs. And so, you know, two decades ago, we had separate banking networks. We had separate networks for controlling important industrial systems like nuclear power plants and the like. Now, to save money, we've put that all on the Internet. We've made it all Internet accessible. If it's accessible to you and me, it's accessible to bad guys, no matter where they're located. We've rolled out services without, you know, thinking about or in any way internalizing the real cost of those services when security is compromised. And individuals, frankly, are often protected. You know, like when a credit card is stolen, the huge hack that, for example, Target endured, individuals are largely protected because Congress has already insured our credit cards. We don't pay for fraudulent charges. But, of course, we do pay for them through higher prices. We pay for them in other ways. And I think more and what we're going to see is the price that we're already paying is going to become more visible. And in this case, for these actresses, it's become very visible.
Do you think that part of it could be that there wasn't that much education about what the cloud was? I mean, it seemed like a nifty techie term that was billed as good news to everybody. But I don't know how deep the average consumer understood exactly what the cloud was and what the possible vulnerabilities there were. I mean, maybe it was up to the techie gatekeepers to do more education and ask some big questions before, you know, putting it all out there.
Well, I certainly agree with you that there wasn't a lot of education that most people don't understand. I'm not sure that it actually matters because, you know, what happens is we dangle a new service in front of people. We say, look, every picture you take on your iPhone can now be accessible from every other device you own. Won't that be terrific? And people say, yeah, I love that. And then in the fine print, we say, and by the way, it means if it's accessible to you, it might be accessible to others. And what we know from a lot of research and a lot of experience is people just ignore those warnings. They don't internalize that risk. They just assume it will happen to somebody else, not them. And as a result, as long as the candy is offered, we're going to go for it, no matter what the potential risk associated with it is.
We're talking about our online security in the era of the cloud and the aftermath of a massive release by hackers of private, often nude images of over 100 celebrities.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. How secure do you feel online? Do you avoid storing certain kinds of things online on your computer, maybe your phone or your tablet? Have you been the victim of some form of hacking or data theft? Or maybe you're in the cybersecurity business and you've got some insight? Let us know what you think. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with cybersecurity expert Fred Kate. We're talking about internet privacy and security in the era of the cloud after this week's release of hacked nude photos of over 100 celebrities.
And you can join in. Do you fear for your data? Do you use the cloud to store documents and photos? Or are you, like a lot of us, unclear on where the stuff we save goes? Who might have access to it? Call in with your questions and your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post over at the Central Time Facebook page. Fred, what is a consumer to do seeing all this? Are there things we can do, not waiting for the internet providers or the governments to take steps? What can we do to make ourselves a little more secure?
Well, there are things we can do. And so the first is don't panic. Most people do not suffer from having their data taken or exposed. Most people it doesn't even happen to. Second of all is do those things you can. And unfortunately, they're the things we keep saying to do that no one likes to do. Strong passwords. Don't use the same password across accounts. Change them with some regularity and don't share them with anyone. Because if anyone has your password, they are you. There's no difference online. And if that means, as people often say, well, I have to write it down, write it down. Much better to have a list of passwords that someone has to be physically present to steal than to use a bad password that they can steal from a foreign country or they can steal from some remote location. And then, you know, the same common sense that we use day to day in our everyday lives about, you know, where you walk, is it safe to walk down this street, is this a safe, restaurant or store to use a credit card in, use the same common sense online, too. So, you know, if you're visiting a recognized site, if you're at Amazon.com, I think you can use a credit card with great comfort. If you're someplace you've never been or if someone's approached you, if you've gotten an incoming email asking for your information, be suspicious. Think twice before providing it, just like you would in any other setting.
We're going to go to our phones now and take a call from Rob in Sussex. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how you doing?
Pretty good. What do you think?
I think that the cloud's never going to be 100% secure. And if you don't want anybody to see it, I wouldn't put it up there. Or at least if you do, put it in like a WinRAR file that you encrypt with a password or something like that and then upload that onto there. Because hackers and security companies, they just go back and forth on who can get in what. You know, hackers figure it out, then security boosts up, and then hackers figure out that. I think that's to be the way it always is.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Rob taking the let the buyer beware sort of mentality there, that you should probably never feel too secure about anything you post online. Is that a good place to begin?
Well, I think it's a really important reminder, and that is at the end of the day, nothing's going to be entirely secure online. Nothing may be entirely secure anywhere else. I mean, remember, when you have things in your home, we have locks on our doors and locks on our windows and alarm systems, and maybe you have a dog and you leave the lights on. But still, if somebody knows you've got something valuable there, they may break in and steal it, and that is certainly true online as well. He does make a very important point, and that is for things like documents and emails and things you may be storing, you can use encryption. They're easy consumer products now that will say, look, if somebody else finds these, they're just going to be gibberish. They're not going to be able to see them. Also, Apple makes available, again, for free and as part of its regular service through iTunes, you can require more than just a password to access your cloud. And therefore, that gives you a greater form of authentication. It's both more burdensome for you, but it's also more burdensome for anyone trying to break into your account.
Thanks a lot for the call, Rob. We'll go now to Stephen in Milwaukee. Stephen, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is very timely. Yesterday, my bank called me, said, are you trying to make a transaction? And I'm like, no. Well, this is the second time that this happened to me. The last time it was in July, that my debit card information has been compromised, and I have no idea how anybody could be getting my information.
Stephen, thanks a lot for the call. A lot of ways, I guess, that information can get out there, including that big Target breach came out a while ago and the new breach apparently at Home Depot. I don't even know all the details on that. Is that where they might have gotten Stephen's data, or are there other ways too, Fred?
Lots of ways, unfortunately. And I mean, the good news here is the bank caught it, and the bank almost always catches it. As far as we know, about 6 out of 8 times the bank catches fraudulent efforts to use a credit card or use a debit card. But any place you use your debit or credit card could be collecting that information and using it fraudulently. I mean, think about how many times, like in a restaurant, you hand your credit card to someone who disappears with it. That's a very common way of they use what's called a skimmer, and they make an electronic copy of your card. Or sometimes it'll be a business or an employee at a business that will be running a little scam on their own where they're copying down information off these cards. It happens a lot in foreign countries or, you know, places you've never been before. So that's why you'll find banks are a lot more vigilant about charges that come from unusual places.
Now, we've been talking a lot about, you know, things we can do on the consumer end, on our end. I mean, it might be a hassle and a drag, but there are things we can do. But what about the burden that maybe should be on the companies to protect us, to keep us safe? For instance, you know, it sort of seems, I guess, a little surprising that Apple let you try an infinite number of times to hack into a cell phone account in their cloud. What do you think companies should be doing?
Yeah, it's astonishing. And, you know, at this point, I think it's clear companies need a little bit of what you might think of as a legal nudge to try to raise the standard across the board. Some companies are doing better than others, and of course, if you're in a business like banking or healthcare, you have legal requirements that you have to provide a certain level of security, and so, you know, we see a higher security in those environments. I do think that we should remember, just as the first caller noted, this is sort of an arms race, and so as we get better protection and hackers get more sophisticated and then we get better protection, it's going to be a process. It's not got a clear end in sight. And that's unfortunate, and that's kind of scary, but that's unfortunately right now just the way it is.
Fred, I wanted to ask you about the law enforcement angle here. You mentioned the analogy of someone breaking into a house. At least there, law enforcement has a solid geographic starting point, the house. If someone breaks into your storage on the cloud, they could be anywhere on the planet. How hard is it to enforce laws on this?
It's pretty difficult. It is an area in which law enforcement's improved dramatically over the past decade. So, you know, 10 years ago, if you had gone to the police and said, my storage has been hacked, they wouldn't even know what you were talking about. And today, most large police departments, and certainly the FBI and the Secret Service, have very sophisticated cyber crimes units. One of the great things about digital technology is, even though it's easy to access, you almost always leave a trail. And so, in some ways, it's an easier place to be able to track down, or at least, you know, get some idea where the attack came from. But you mentioned a lot of these attacks do come from overseas, and that's when you just run into a jurisdictional problem. There are a lot of countries we don't have close cooperative relationships with, and if that's where the attack originates from, it's going to be pretty hard to do much about it.
Let's go back to our phones now. We've got another call. Let's see, this is from another Rob, I should say, this one in Solon Springs. Hi there, Rob.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you think?
My comment was simply about celebrities being high profile. It's hard to feel sorry for them in this day and age, and we live in the day and age of social media, and everything that you put out there, once it's out there, it's really out there. And I think, the celebrities, they're a target. People want to know what they're doing. So that was the first comment on that. The second thing was just trying to educate young people as far as pictures that they're taking, things that they say, to let them know once it's out there, once it's on the internet, you can't protect it. There's no taking it back. So as the father of a 10-year-old, trying to educate him as far as the social media goes, Facebook, what he's doing, what he's saying, what he's posting, I think we just need to do a real good job of communicating that to our young people so that they can protect themselves.
Right, and that's a great point. Thank you, Rob. And does it start, do you think, Fred, with education at home, with kids, with this generation that's growing up with sort of, you know, life lived forever online? Is there a way to make that hit home?
Yeah. And interestingly, I mean, of course, you know, kids are using these technologies incredibly early, and often they are more advanced than their parents. And so, one thing you see is a lot of efforts to educate children, educate them in kindergarten or educate them in the, grade school. Also, those important behavioral lessons, exactly like Rob was mentioning. I mean, even, in the law school where I teach, we're constantly telling students, if you put it out there, it's going to be out there forever. You know, delete does not really work in the cloud or online. There are a lot of educational efforts that companies, that universities, that others do that try to break this down into really simple terms. So, like, if you own an iPhone, how do you set security on it? And you can go to securitymatters.iu.edu, and you can see the short 3-minute videos we do there, but there are many other examples of those as well.
Fred, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Fred Cade. He's Distinguished Professor of Law and Senior Fellow at the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University. We've been talking about this week's release of hacked celebrity photos and what it means for all of our privacy and security online.